Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to episode 4 of our new run of Today's Football Times. I am Stephen Scragg. I am at the wheel of the game, which is again a surreal occurrence. But yeah, this is going to be fine. This is going to be an hour or so's chat about all manner of football and topics. And tonight we have the wonderful Dave Bowler back for another go after last week's show. Hi, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Episode 4, and they said it wouldn't last.
No, here we are again, back by popular demand, I would say ourselves, or at least availability on the Sunday night. Everyone else is watching Strictly Come Dancing, or it's half term for some, and you know they're probably up to their armpits in child entertainment, I imagine. And in the opposite end of the triangle that we have tonight, the other point of the triangle, we have Chris Lepkowski. How are we, Chris?
I'm just glad to be here, really. I did toy with Strictly, but I thought this sounded like a much better idea. So it's great to be here.
We get Strictly Come Dancing on in our house. My youngest was absolutely, you know, absorbed with it for a year or two. Dr. Range, a few years ago, from a famous figure from children's television, an actual doctor as well, an actual practicing doctor, and she was devastated when he got knocked out. There were tears. I was actually recording a podcast on the night that he got knocked out, and I was upstairs and I could hear the devastation from my little cocoon upstairs, kind of like way downstairs in the distance. So yeah, no, we must be reverential in this house about Strictly Come Dancing. Anyway, no Strictly Come Dancing tonight. We are strictly into the football. So yes, let's go with. We'll start with Chris tonight. What's your topic of conversation?
I'm going to go for Strictly Shambolic, if I may. And that is you might have guessed from my accent that I don't hail from Liverpool or London or Manchester, but from the West Midlands. And I bring shame to our table, horror, embarrassment. What is going on in the West Midlands right now? And I'm saying this on the evening that Aston Villa have trounced Brentford by 4 goals after relieving Steven Gerrard of his long overdue duties, according to Villa fans that I know. But I'm just looking at the stats here, and if we take what I would consider to be the kind of three big West Midlands clubs, being Wolves, Villa and West Brom, and apologies to Birmingham fans for that, but they're doing all right. So conveniently, I'm going to leave them out. But West Brom, 23rd. In the table, in the championship. De facto bottom if Huddersfield win their game in hand. Wolves in the Premier League, 19th. Aston Villa, 14th. And Villa, no away wins. Wolves, no away wins. West Brom, 1 away win. I mean, it's just a sorry state of affairs. And I've always been of the view that our football clubs have suffered from an identity crisis. I think they've suffered from never fulfilling potential. But this is a becoming a new low, all joking aside. I mean, Aston Villa have got the fourth wealthiest owners in the Premier League, we're told. For them to be scrambling around in 14th, having invested in Steven Gerrard, relative rookie managerial terms, but a winner in Scotland, you know, and he's come down. It's not worked for him at all. I think it's been, you know, listening to supporters in the area. They've got ambitions of Tuchel, Pochettino, Unai Emery being mentioned. I'm not sure any of those are going to happen. And then you've got Wolves down the road, 19th, backed by Fosun. A huge investment into the club, into the infrastructure, rebuilt part of Molineux. And yet they seem to have suddenly had this trigger moment where it's almost reality has hit them that they've invested all this money for basically finishing no more than seventh or sixth in the table. that reality of, well, why have we done this? What's the point of it? We can't break into that top four in the way that Newcastle maybe can, or maybe that West Ham tried to. And they that their whole progress has grown to a halt. And then West Brom, who, you know, one division lower and 10 years ago were coming to terms with, you know, Roy Hodgson leaving the club and wondering how to replace a guy who'd left them for England. Now, they're 2 weeks without a manager, and as we record this now, still haven't announced Steve Bruce's successor. What a mess. And I'd be interested to get your take, really, guys, on what you think has gone wrong and how this region, which is blessed and rich with good football heritage, how it returns to maybe where it should be.
Dave, any takes?
Many. There is a lot of rich football heritage in the West Midlands, except most of it happened in black and white, unfortunately. Because I mean, all right, Villa obviously were in the Premier League from the inception. Had some great years in the Premier League, but I mean, really, you look at the last 40 years since Villa won the European Cup. What has this region won? I mean, I think Villa, did they win? They've won a League Cup since then, possibly. But I mean, Albion,
they won two, yeah, 94, 96.
I yeah, and Albion went down as far as the third division. Wolves went down as far as the fourth division in the 80s, early 90s. Took a long while to come back. Albion and even Wolves, really, even in this current run, when they've got back into the Premier League, they've done nothing, really. I know it's a changed game now from what it was back in the 80s when they were up there. But it's a region that's really done nothing for a long, long, long time. I mean, me and you, Chris, have had this conversation many a time over the years. There is an element where you wonder, not that you can do anything about it, but you wonder if there's too many clubs and it's too split, it gets too divided in a relatively small area. But I think it's a region with not an identity crisis, but it's a very self-deprecating region. It doesn't shout about itself at all very much. And I think if you're a foreign footballer or a foreign manager looking to come into this country, Manchester, Liverpool, London are all a lot more exciting and more interesting places to go. I don't know that anybody knows anything much about Birmingham or Wolverhampton outside the area. So I think that is a big problem in terms of getting people in.
It seems that the kind of golden age, and I know you mentioned football in black and white, but it seems the kind of golden age of West Midlands football was missed in the late 1970s. You know, you had West Bromwich Albion under Ron Atkinson with the likes of Brian Robson, Cyril Regis, Cunningham, Tony Byrne. Then you had Villa, who were on the verge, had already won the League Cup under Saunders, ended up winning the league in 81 and the European Cup. Wolves got to the League Cup final in 80. Birmingham had the guy who was the most expensive footballer in England in Trevor Francis. And the region never kicked on. West Brom lost Atkinson to United, lost Brian Robson. Wolves went into a terminal decline that ended up in Division 4. Aston Villa, within 4 years of winning the European Cup, had fallen out with the manager who won them the league. They then went into a decline of their own, got relegated to the second division within 4 years of that success. And it just seems, and you're absolutely right, Dave, that when you think of Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, London, these are areas that champion themselves. They not just the football fans, but people there, they champion their regions. You would never hear of a Liverpudlian putting down his city or a Mancunian putting down Manchester, and yet Brummies, West Midlanders, are thinking, oh, well, you're right, you know, it's not a great area, but we're proud of it. You know, we're Brummies, we're all right. And there's never been that pride that maybe other regions have in their surroundings. It's always been, as you say, self-deprecating.
I mean, from my perspective, I mean, I think it depends as well what generation you come from. I mean, I've often said it as a Liverpool supporter who came to football in the late 70s, early 80s, that the rivalry, the threat didn't come from on our doorstep. It came from the Midlands, you know, both East and West. You know, there was an Aston Villa of great substance that won the league title, that went on to win the European Cup under Tony Barton. You know, Cloughs Forest. You know, these were the teams that I came to football on. You know, these were our rivals. These were the threats for trophies. European Cups were won by them as well. You know, so if we weren't winning it, they seem to have a, you know, and that's just what I grew up on. So in a way, you know, I always go back to that reset. You know, I always quite like to see teams that were knocking around the first division and prospering in the cup competitions when I was at that impressionable age. I often want them to come back and to prosper and to do well, because it's a reconnection with youth in a way. You know, and that's the way, you know. So I always kind of kept an eye on the situation at Villa Park and the City Ground and stuff like that. The variables of football, contemporary football, it's that massive tilting of the landscape. You know, it is so hard to keep pace at the top if you've not got that big open checkbook, if you've not got that sugar daddy from far out east, or, you know, I mean, even the Americans, you know, find it hard to keep up, to keep pace with the oil-rich Emirates. So, you know, it's not just a Midlands, you know, specific problem, I don't think. In a way, they do so much better than other parts of the country. You know, if you do comparable parts of the country, like the North East, yeah, Newcastle are a completely different kettle of fish now, or at least trying to be a different kettle of fish. A different landscape that they've got now. But, you know, Sunderland, you know, have only just climbed out of the third tier, a club that have known better times. Middlesbrough are back down in the second tier and have been for a good few years. They must have spent, you know, the vast majority of the last 15 years in the second tier now. You know, you look at Yorkshire, you know, there have been spans of time where Yorkshire haven't had a top flight representative. You know, so for me, Villa are one of those that, you know, I always peg around that little middle section of clubs that have the potential to do better than they do, but could do worse than they do. You know, Everton are another one that I would have in that section of clubs. Newcastle, you know, they have that rich heritage of having had a successful past and have the potential to stretch for it again in the future, but it's a different landscape of football now. I mean, the fable kind of like Big Six, Newcastle trying to make it a Big Seven. You know, who's the next club that gets picked off to be, you know, the plaything of a conglomerate from God knows where? It's, in a way, it's perverse to say it, but the only way we get something akin to a level playing field is if they're all massively oil-rich clubs, in a way. You know, and it's sad to say it. You know, because even kind of like the feel-good stories of someone like a Bournemouth picking their way through the divisions and being in administration all that time ago and threats to their existence, and here they are back in the Premier League. You know, it isn't as clear-cut of a foundation that success has been built upon. You know, money is behind everything in football, and, you know, it is the haves and have-nots. Steven Gerrard and Christian Perslow. You know, we're all too familiar with the work of Christian Perslow at Anfield. So we know that it can be unstable ground, that such empires or prospective empires are built upon. Yeah, it always comes down to that. I don't know, it's that repeating the system again. You know, this hasn't worked, what do we do? You know, Aston Villa were in that situation that Dean Smith brought them back into the Premier League. In a way, that's where Nottingham Forest are now. They have their Dean Smith and Steve Cooper. You know, do they stick? Do they twist? Yeah, you know, they've got a great result out of us yesterday. But if they don't win one for the, you know, this side of the World Cup now, or, you know, feasibly, they don't win another game until New Year, given that there's a World Cup that's going to stop everything for 5 to 6 weeks. But yeah, you know, it's so hard to see, you know, what is the right answer to the clubs in these situations, and what is the glass ceiling? You know, where are these clubs wanting to be? That's often my question when I get into conversations with clubs, of supporters of specific clubs like that. I get into a lot of conversations with Everton supporters. You know, what is it that you expect of your club? What is the target? You know, what you know, we always say shoot. You know, the fabled kind of like status. You know, shoot for the stars. You might. You know, reach the clouds, or you might reach the moon. You know, what is the moon for these football clubs? Is it winning a League Cup? Is it getting into the Europa League? You know, reaching the Champions League is hard for two out of the big six clubs every season. Where are the doors going to open for an Aston Villa at the minute? You know, what is the realism?
I mean, I think that's a good point, because if you go back 12 years, 13, 14 years, Villa were doing quite nicely. It was Randy Lerner had come in, he brought his money in. Martin O'Neill was getting them in the top six. And they looked like they were ready to move on a little bit more. And then I think it was Manchester City. The big money came into Manchester City and Randy Lerner looked at it and thought, I'll bugger this for a game. Because there's always going to be somebody with more money than me. He lost interest and Villa started to drop away from there. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is about who gets the right investor. Getting the right investor is probably more important than getting the right centre forward.
I mean, it's interesting that parallel between the Villa of Randy Lerner, possibly, and the Wolves of Fosun, you know. When you think of that initial investment, that whole narrative of Fosun coming in and, you know, sort of trying out Walter Zenger didn't quite work, and then hit upon this guy, Nuno, who just built them from the bottom up, took him into the Premier League, playing, this football with a bit of a swagger, a bit of passion. I've always shied away from that being an attribute of football, but he brought that to Wolverhampton, and you know, they had a great couple of years back in the Premier League, and it just seems like they've lost their way badly. I mean, Bruno Lage, on the face of it, seemed a steady appointment, but clearly fell away, players weren't reacting to him, and it just feels like the owners have had that moment that Randy Lerner had, where maybe Newcastle have become that Manchester City, and they're thinking, well, what can we possibly do with our billions to change the whole dynamic of the Premier League, when there's an entire nation effectively taking over Newcastle, oil money, and we can't compete with that. And what's the point in competing with that? We might as well take our money and reinvest it elsewhere. And I think the whole issue around the Super League and the clubs that compete in that, and the threat that brings to English football, because it is a threat to the whole value of the Premier League product, that must be at the back of a few minds, especially for those clubs like Villa, like Wolves, like West Ham, who maybe have ambitions, Everton as well, of being in that top four or five, but in reality knowing that it's unlikely to happen.
That class season is a good point. I mean, me and Chris know from the working on the inside at West Brom, you know, working for when Tony Pulis was there, and it wasn't particularly attractive and it wasn't particularly exciting, and the supporters quickly got fed up with it. But Albion were 10th, 11th, 12th in the Premier League, and that kind of is, whether you like it or not, that is the glass ceiling for a club like Albion. Now, you know, we can argue whether they should have tried harder in the cup competitions and that kind of thing. To be fair to Pulis, he generally did. But I think, you know, for a club like Albion, finishing 11th or 12th is as good as it gets. Probably Villa would look two or three places higher, as good as it gets. Wolves, the same. But there's no way you're going to, you know, you talk about the big six, the big seven. You're not going to get into that. Not at the moment, anyway.
No, not without, you know, finding that big checkbook. And, you know, it's the lottery winning clubs in a way, isn't it? You know, I don't begrudge any set of supporters, especially, you know, long suffering set of supporters, that moments of glory and that chance to live the dream and to you know, enjoy the ride as such. But yeah, it is that middle section of clubs that, I don't know, does it get too boring for supporters? Is that what it comes down to? Does stability, you know, mid-table water treading and reaching for kind of like, you know, potential Europa League qualification? I mean, West Ham, you know, a great case in point from last season, you know, they came so close to reaching the Europa League final. You know, that's, you know, amazing stuff. You know, a Leicester City isn't going to happen, you know, too often. So yes, these are exceptions, but you know, there's been countless clubs down the years that have rode that kind of like middle ground, looked really well run club, only to unravel. Charlton Athletic, perpetually seventh or eighth under Alan Kirbishley for a long, long time. You know, decided that, you know, he decided to move on, or they tried to move in a different direction, and you know, look where it got them. Sunderland were another one, you know, that were very comfortable for a long time with Kevin Phillips scoring goals galore for them. But it's that desire for that extra step forward, and when that doesn't happen, that frustration that kicks in, or must kick in. Yeah, it's that need to turn the next card and say, you know, what is it? But how often does that next card, that extra roll of the dice, know, come up with success. It very, very, very rarely does. And teams often, you know, people will point out that a lot of clubs and projects will work in 3-year cycles as well. And it's about turning that 3-year cycle into a 6-year cycle, into a 9-year cycle. You know, Wolves have been, you know, wonderfully consistent for some time, and they've hit a sticky ground now. You know, this is where either the self-destruct button is hit, or, you know, they find calmer water. You know, they shopped very well. You know, they came up with a really good, you know, framework for what they had. You know, they had a great eye on the Portuguese league, you know, picked up some fine players at good prices, and then in a way they mirrored what Southampton did for a long time. Southampton had a wonderful system on the go, you know, and we picked off players from them, you know, on a regular basis for a few years. But it's, again, there's a lot of energy in being a visionary football club and having that kind of setup. You know, it will be an exhausting kind of scenario to run that way for half a decade, let alone a full decade. And yeah, you know, the fans are demanding, and they will want that success. They'll want something to walk away from and say, this period of sustainability, and, you know, now where's the trophy to show for it? You know, where is that day in the sunshine, you know, to be able to tell the grandkids and the kids and stuff like that? You know, I don't envy the situation. In a way, I mean, that system of clubs, you know, Dave mentioned it last week about, you know, West Brom and having that, you know, it's almost a relief to be out of it for a while, to be able to go into the Championship and win games, you know, rather than having that drudgery of not seeing a win for 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks in the Premier League. There are so many kind of, I don't know, dividing lines in the top, not just the top tier of English football now, but the top two tiers, you know, where it's interchangeable. You know, that top 6 or 7 runs away with it in the Premier League now, but then you have that middle ground, but teams in the middle ground, you know, can easily fall into that lower category. And once you're in that lower category, you have that danger of being sucked into the Championship. You know, so many yo-yo clubs as well. You know, it's finding that, I don't know, that niche, really, and making it work. You know, and whereas West Ham have managed to do that, for instance, in the last season or two, wouldn't be surprised in the slightest if it all started to unravel because of that frustration and not going that step further in clinching that Champions League place or reaching that Europa League final. When you get that type of success that comes so close and it's, you know, so near so far, it becomes an itch. It becomes, you know, that terrible, terrible itch that you just can't scratch.
That's the Midlands.
We have the Midlands.
It's the coat of arms of the Midlands.
But anyway, moving away from the Midlands then, Dave, what have you brought us to the table?
It's somewhere on the up, actually. There's a bit of a revival going on at Ipswich Town. I've been doing some work with them a little bit this season. It's 20 years now since Ipswich were in the Premier League, and I've been in League One since 2019. Now 3 seasons. They got relegated in 2019 in the worst possible way, 31 points. I mean, that's a proper relegation, and they've never looked like getting back since then. So there was a takeover by an American concern, Game Changer 20. April 21, and I think that's kick-started everything. The leadership of the club's changed, and the mindset's been transformed. I think that there was like a statement of intent, a bit like Nottingham Forest, but in a different kind of way. Last summer, they brought in 19 players, which seems a bit mental, but I think it sent out a real message. Mark Ashton's the CEO there, and I think him and the board wanted to send out a message that, you know, these last 2 or 3 years have not been good enough, and we've got to wash this away. This is a ground zero moment, and I think inside a football club, you mustn't underestimate it, what an important dynamic that is, because it's very easy inside a club to just drift and drift and drift, and if somebody comes in and says, "Bang, right, everybody out, this new lot in," that really just is a cultural shift, and it changes everybody's thinking. I mean, inevitably last season there was a bit of a stutter. I mean, you know, they didn't start particularly well, and Paul Cook left in last December, and yeah, you kind of feel for him a bit, because a lot of the players that they brought in last summer have gone on and done really well this season. Christian Walton in goal, George Edmondson, centre-half, Connor Chaplin, Lee Evans, Sam Morsey, Wes Burns. They were all bought by under Cook's watch, but they've been kicked on by Kieran McKenna, who I think he's one of those new breed of managers, and he looks like he's going to be something. He's going to be a star, I think. He's only 35. He was at Spurs Academy, went to United's Academy, and worked for Mourinho and Solskjaer. And he's very, very impressive guy. Very modern in his ideas, his values, the way he picks the team, particularly up front. He'll change the front three or four game by game, depending on the opponent. He won't always stick with the same team. Using the subs well. They keep the ball really well. I mean, you know, whatever you want to put on stats is you know, up to your own personal taste. But I mean, they're a 65% of the ball team most of the time in League One, which, you know, is a big statement in League One, because it's not necessarily renowned for that sort of type of football. They bought well again in the summer. But I think they've done a lot of stuff right on the pitch. But what's impressed me, having got to know a little bit about them as well, is they're really good off the pitch. The staff are very good, the support staff, the staff in the offices. The foundation as well is a great job of working with the community. I think that's really underestimated. There's a big buy-in to that community, and the supporters have felt it, and they've got on board with it. They've really, yeah, they've had a good marketing thing where they've reduced prices through this last month, because they had three games at home in 20 days, and they've had 27,000, 28,000 people at Portman Road. Now, in League One, that's saying something. That's a real push forward. You know, the media guys are there. They're well organised. That, you know, they've got good staff. They produce good content. And when they deliver a player to you, that player's got something to say. They're an articulate bunch. They'll sit down and talk to you. And I mean, as we all know, it's not always the easiest thing to get a footballer to sit down and spend 15 minutes with you and talk properly without looking at his watch every couple of seconds and you know, wanting to get off and get on the road. There's just something, it feels to me that there's something going on there bigger than, you know, oh, we've won a few games and we've got 30 points and we're in second place, you know. I mean, again, talking about the supporters, 1,000 of them went to Plymouth a couple of weeks back for a midday kickoff on Sky. Yeah, they were getting on the coaches at 3:30 on a Sunday morning to get to Plymouth for that game. Now, that's not happening if people don't feel there's something big going on there. And I think, you know, there's a lot of good characters in that team, in that dressing room, and a lot of good characters in the staff, the coaching staff, the media staff, in the offices as well. I think they've got good leadership. I think Mark Ashton knows what he's doing. He's doing something. I mean, he went to Watford as CEO 2005, I think it was, when he uncovered Aidy Boothroyd as their manager, and they got promoted straight away. They're doing a lot right, I think, there. And not only are they doing things right, but I think they're getting stuff in a position where it's going to last for, you know, you've just been talking about three-year cycles and that kind of thing. You can see that there's a plan there for the next 3, 5, 6 years. Whether they'll get promoted this year, I mean, who knows? It's League One's a proper marathon, and you know, but I think they'll have a good chance with it, if it's not this year, within the next couple. And they, you know, they're moving in the right direction to be in the Premier League, I think, in probably 5 years. And for a team that hasn't been there for 20 years, that's a big step.
You mentioned the word culture, Dave. That there's been a change of emphasis on the way the club's going, on the almost like a reboot, a reset, I suppose, is the way of saying it. And it just seems to have been the perfect storm for them in many ways, with the takeover of the American consortium and Mark Ashton, Mike O'Leary, who I know from my West Brom days covering the club, the Birmingham Mail, he was chief executive there. Two football men who know the game inside out, know what it takes to succeed in football, how to build clubs up. And it's just from the outside looking in, it just feels like a club that's on the up. You know, even if they fail to get the prize this season off promotion, be it playoffs or automatic, they're not going to be far away. And there's an investment in the future of the club. So if this guy doesn't work, and by all accounts he is doing well, McKenna, then they'll have a plan. They'll have something in mind that will be, I think it's almost, we call it succession planning. So if McKenna does well, takes them up, maybe gets poached, there will be something in place to ensure that that continuity of progress continues. And I think that's very easy to overlook sometimes. It's we talk about the football being the here and now. It's all about the result today, what's gone on the pitch today. But planning and mapping out a future for a football club is perhaps more important, especially for a club like Ipswich, who have been on that downward spiral for so long. It's perhaps the most important thing, making sure that you've got a structure in place to get your club back on a pathway to progress.
Yeah, that, I think that's right. I mean, again, it goes back to some of the stuff that Stephen was saying before about where's your glass ceiling, what do the fans expect? And I think you know, if you've been at the Premier League for 20 years, you don't expect miracles overnight because, you know, you've had a long run without. But I think if you can change the mindset of people, if you can harness the community, that's a powerful thing. And I think we talked about the Midlands a few minutes ago, and there's four big teams, if Walsall will forgive me, within a very small area, and that maybe dilutes it. Well, of course, in Ipswich, there's nobody for miles. You know, you are a one-team town. If you do that right, that's powerful. I mean, you know, one of the guys, George Edmondson, he bought the disabled team. He bought all their kit for them. Paid for it himself and gave him the kit. Now, that seems a small thing, but you do a bunch of those little small things and people start to get behind you. And that, it feels, sometimes, as you said, a football club, you need a reset, and it feels like they've had one, but one that's more than cosmetic. I mean, they've got this mantra of run towards adversity. Now, I'm a cynical old git, and ordinarily I would look at that with a fairly jaundiced eye. But it seems like they actually mean it. I mean, if you remember that old Alex Ferguson thing, you've all got to be pointing towards the top of the mountain from the tea lady upwards. And it feels like that kind of thing is going on there. So, you know, I think it's one of those revivals that looks like it's got some legs on it.
It's a lot of those type of projects are built on belief. Mm. And, you know, it is, you know, I always remember, what was it? It was when Luis Garcia was signing for Liverpool, or been offered the chance to go to Liverpool, and he asked Michael Robinson his opinion, and his saying was, what he said to him was that you're not joining a football club, you're joining a cause, and I love that as a phrase. Being a Liverpool supporter, I would do, but I believe something in that is that, you know, if you create an environment at a football club that makes it feel like it's everyone. As a vested interest, from the, like you said, from the tea laid down, that there isn't that hierarchy as such, that, you know, everyone plays a part in shifting that club from one direction to another, then, you know, you can break those barriers, you can break through, you know, the seemingly impossible. You know, you can you set out what your mountain is and you can conquer it. You know, for a club like Ipswich, there's no reason why they shouldn't set out and say, look, the target is the Premier League. Because, you know, for clubs like Ipswich, who have known better times, and, you know, UEFA Cup that was won, an FA Cup that was won, you know, a treble that was chased, you know, again, going back to my childhood and those early 1980s, you know, they were a club of purpose. So, you know, I always relate Ipswich to being, you know, a club that shouldn't be where they are. They should be higher up. They should be doing a lot better. But they've also got contemporary, you know, examples to follow. You know, a Leeds United who were down in the third tier at one point, who are back in the Premier League now, and have been for 3 years. Nottingham Forest, you know, they dipped into the third tier, and, you know, for, and considering how dysfunctional Forest were for a long, long time over those years, you know, nothing is impossible to come back from in that respect. So yeah, for me, Ipswich should aim high. You know, the you know. They're looking at, you know, Norwich themselves, you know, the great infidels from Norfolk, as far as Ipswich will be concerned. You know, they themselves did it, and it was back-to-back promotions that took them up. And yes, they've yo-yoed out of the top, you know, between the top two divisions for what seems like an eternity now. But, you know, they themselves were down in that third tier. Leicester City, another club that found themselves marooned in the third tier, and they've gone on and done, you know, ludicrous things that, you know, yeah, that level of achievement is maybe a pipe dream. But, you know, it's certainly not against them to be able to reach out. And again, it's a volatile part of the world as far as, you know, where the football club has meandered over the years. You know, from those peaks of the 80s under Bobby Robson to, you know, the depths of despair and water treading in the second division to better days again under George Burley. You know, when they got back into the Premier League, reached the UEFA Cup and then it all regressed again. But, you know, it's also about eliminating, you know, the mistakes, not repeating the same mistakes over again. This is what a lot of football clubs will do, is that repetitive nature of, you know, we come up with a plan A doesn't work, and plan B is repeat plan A, you know, no matter how badly wrong it went. You know, and it does take fresh thinking, it does take, you know, often new impetus and new people to come in. And just to kind of point out the basics, you know, football doesn't have to be, you know, the complex game that people set it out to be. And the basics, doing the basics very, very well can take you a long, long way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a simple game, people complicated. Who said that?
Yes. Oh, most definitely, most definitely. Moving away from English football, my topic is Sevilla. I'm just totally bewitched by what they seem to be doing to themselves. They've been, I don't know, probably Spain's most consistent club outside of the cartel of Barcelona, Real Madrid, and I suppose Atletico Madrid that you can throw in there now for what they've been doing for the last decade or so. But yeah, consistent Champions League qualification, Europa Leagues won by the bucket load. And just a fine example of how to run a Spanish football club for so long. Yet here they are, you know, what, 11 games into the new season. They've only won two. They're down in 15th. They're only a point away from the bottom three. They've sacked the manager who has been coveted by Wolves, Julian Lopetegui, replaced by Jorg Sampaoli. You know, they've been beaten by Real Madrid, which isn't, you know, the biggest stain that they'll have this season. But contrived to draw against a Valencia that isn't doing particularly well. And then they've really doing very, very poorly in the Champions League. I find it fascinating when a football club of repute and, you know, a club that at one point, not all that long ago, probably had designs on trying to, you know, reach out for a long-awaited La Liga title. Now, one of the few Spanish clubs to win the league title, and there's only eight or nine that have actually been champions of Spain across the near 100 years of Spanish league football. But yeah, it's that implosion of a club of substance that fascinates me. And in a way, it's being mirrored in English football by Leicester City. You know, you could point to similarities between the two clubs. And again, it's almost hypnotic to watch this unfold. What's your take, Dave?
As you said, the similarities with Leicester. I wonder if a club that comes from outside the, you know, inverted commas, the elite, the expected winners, and so on, if there's just a lifespan for that bit of success that they do get, you know, the effort that it takes to keep competing at that level with clubs who have got that much more resource, that much more opportunity. I just wonder if there comes a point where, you know, you've done it for, well, I guess they've been doing it for sort of 10 years now, haven't they? That kind of level, winning Europa Leagues and that sort of stuff. I just wonder if there comes to a point where you're just absolutely exhausted by it and you've hollowed the place out and you can't, because you're constantly having to be at your absolute maximum if you want to compete at that level and you've got those smaller resources. Whereas a Barcelona or a Real Madrid can perhaps be at 90% and still be doing pretty well. They've got to be at 100% and perhaps a bit more just to stay up there. And I wonder if it just comes to a point where you've given it everything. Everybody in the club's given it everything. And there's nothing left to give for a while. And you have to have a fallow period. And then the real trick is, can you do it again?
To come back again. Yeah, I often find kind of like a club like that, you know, as it is with Sevilla's kind of, it's almost like the political party that runs out of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, in some in some respects, they need to be relegated, or they need to be, not to stop and then come back again. You know, I'm sure when the chance arises. But yeah, you know, I do find Sevilla particularly fascinating, because these cycles that clubs go around in do tend to be quite short lived. It's 3-4 years, you know, and then it's gone. And they've managed to keep this going for quite some time, really. They were relegated a couple of times towards the tail end of the 1990s, early noughties, and they haven't been the only, you know, relatively big Spanish club to befall that. Atletico Madrid themselves went down around about 2000. Real Betis, you know, another team that has great pretensions to do well, have lost top flight status, you know, before. And, you know, you only have to look at the sobering experience of Deportivo La Coruña, who just looked set to be around for so long. You know, they won a La Liga title, they were regulars in the Champions League, and the way that they've fallen away. But, you know, it is those shifting landscapes of football, the tectonic plate shift, the style of football changes. You know, you have managers, you know, it will be for Guardiola and the Klopps, you know, that they will fall out of fashion, that new thinking will come along. You have to look at like a Jose Mourinho now, who's plugging away at Roma. You know, the idea of him having a job at one of the underachievers rather than the big checkbook clubs would have been unimaginable 5 years ago. But, you know, this is, you know, the way that football fashions change, and clubs get sucked along into that as well. But for Sevilla to ride all those changes for so long and stay there, I just find the current plight utterly, utterly fascinating. Chris, have you any thoughts?
Well, I mean, you know, I've covered, I've had some serious injuries, a list of players, you know, Jesus Navas, Papu Gomez, Tatakito, Corona, Fernando, all suffering long-term injuries. And I just wonder how much Lopetegui's personal circumstances have been a hindrance, you know, having a poorly relative, and just how much that has impacted on the progress that they were making, and the general consistency that they had. I mean, to deal with injuries is bad enough, and obviously that causes a stress on the team, a stress on the squad, but to then have to be dealing with an intensely personal, deep matter like that, it can't have been helpful, surely.
No, oh, completely. You know, all the variables play into that. I think, you know, as much as injuries play a huge role in that as well, I think it's right that there is an exhaustion of a club, you know, across the board as well. You know, as Dave says, you know, a team will eventually run out of steam almost. You know, an injury is kind of like, will often come along into that. And, you know, I know from Liverpool's perspective at the minute, keep going back to Liverpool, but it's my experience, and you know, it's always going to be my parallel to such instances, is that they've suffered a huge amount of injuries so far this season, but it's not an excuse for the situation that they're currently in, which is, you know, very, very dysfunctional at the minute. You know, one step forward, one to the side, one back is how I would explain it. But the injuries play a part, but it's not completely, you know, the reason to do so. From a Liverpool perspective, we hit a bit of a wall in missing out on the Premier League title and losing the Champions League final within 6 days of each other. It brought a hangover situation. So, you know, whether injuries were there or not, I think we'd be limping along this season regardless. And I think while injuries play the part in Sevilla's current struggles, I think there's a little bit more across the board. And to dispense with Lopetegui as well is, you know, maybe speaks of that, you know, especially the situation he was in. There were no concessions given to him. You know, he was still, you know, ushered to the exit. You know, only 2 years on from winning, you know, the club's latest Europa League. You know, it's an absolutely ruthless game. It is. But moving on to our topics of what we are looking forward to in the week or months ahead, Chris.
I'm really looking forward to there being a time, and I apologise for the lack of time scale here, but I'm hoping that we can get back to a time where people don't feel the need to go to a football match and sing horrific things about Hillsborough or any other stadium disaster. And I know I'm speaking to you, Stephen, in this group as a guy who's
I did think about bringing this myself, and I thought no, I'll not do it. But I'm glad you have. So go for it, Chris.
I mean, I've got no attachment to Liverpool or, you know, or the Hillsborough situation, other than my university dissertation was about the media coverage of Hillsborough. So I dipped into quite a bit of research there, spoke to a few families. So I do have a little bit of insight as to the impact of the disaster. My university dissertation, by the way, is a good few years ago, and things have certainly moved on since then. I think this is a bigger point about football fandom now. What kind of mentality must you go through during a football match, to mock the death of 97 people? I don't get that. And for as long as, and maybe it's because I'm now middle-aged, maybe it's because I don't view football through the same prism of tribalism that I did when I was in my 20s, but I will never understand how it is acceptable for somebody to go and sing songs like that at supporters who are let down not only on the day but have been let down by a succession of groups within the establishment, the state, the police and other stakeholders that day, and how people can think it's acceptable to do that and sing that. I can't fathom that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's quite raw for me. You know, I was at Hillsborough, and I think there's been a lot of, I don't know, it's what happened in Paris at Saint-Denis as well for the Champions League final has brought it into greater focus for Liverpool supporters as well. It's just reawakened a lot of the feeling towards it. So it is a sensitive issue at the minute. As it is, as it stands, three survivors from Hillsborough have committed suicide since the Champions League final, since being present in Paris. And that's, you know, a damning indictment of the situation of that continues to this day. What's quite alarming, really, is that, you know, you over the years, you know, these chants emanated from the most vitriolic of rivals. You know, they came from Old Trafford. They came from Goodison, sadly. You know, it's kind of like escalated from Manchester City supporters. You know, the change in the mood music of Manchester City supporters towards us as well. But a little bit alarmingly, it's kind of escalated to be a weekly thing now. You know, it's come from very, very surprising directions. You know, the fact that Forest supporters were doing it yesterday, the fact that West Ham supporters were doing it in midweek. You know, it Leicester supporters, we've fallen out with there's a bit of rancor between Liverpool and Leicester supporters over the last couple of years. You know, and what it tends to be is I'm finding that it's newer generations that are worse than older generations. Older generations, you know, understood, you know, and they got it. Newer generations come through, younger supporters, and they want to fit in to the landscape of their fan bases. They want to tie in. They want to look the part. And this is a lot of what's happening now, is that it's, you know, it's conformity. It's rebellion in a conformist manner. And there is just a lack of thought. They see it as being, you know, that horrible word. I hate the word banter. You know, it's been hijacked, you know, the word banter. You know, it once meant something completely different. And it has such cynical connotations now. So, yeah, but within that, it's a section of society that do it. You know, I refuse to see it as specific fan bases. You know, yes, some do it more than others, you know, but at the same time, there are some wonderful free thinking, you know, outspoken people that support most clubs, the vast majority, every club really has them, that will shout it down, and they're not afraid to do so. What it'll come down to is a case of education, you know, educating people on the topic, you know, isn't easy because A, you need people who are willing to listen and learn, but also you need the people who are willing to do the teaching of it as well, you know, to put it out there and say, look, this isn't right. You know, I was educated as a Liverpool supporter. You know, most people, everyone's educated as a supporter. They're shown a way of supporting, you know, and it just depends on who your peers are, who the people who are setting examples to you in how you support. You know, I have great respect for other teams and, you know, clubs and the achievements that they've done. You know, I grew up as part of that era of supporter who are shown to applaud the goalkeepers down to the cop and all that type of stuff. And, you know, we have a greater kinship. Sadly, we now have a far greater kinship with supporters who come for European nights than we do for people in our own country. But there are still some shining lights out there. But like I say, education, it needs its two-way street. And also what lets us down a bit is the fact that you can watch a game on television and hear the chants clearly through the television screen, you know, through the speakers of your television screen. And there's never any mention of it by commentators and pundits and analysts. And I'd imagine that they're told not to by television channel, you know, executives. You know, there must be a directive not to mention it. But when it does kick off, it's noticeable that commentators just stay silent. And you can hear it come through the television. It's almost like it's the I don't know, stand towards it. It's to say, look, you can hear it listening without us actually saying it's happening. I'm sure there's probably commentators out there that would love to point it out that can't because they're told not to. But it's a situation I don't see improving, sadly. There's always going to be a schism because it's going to be that we're living in a country that is massively divided. You know, and it is just the way that people are in football grounds are exactly the same that the way that people are on high streets on a Friday night. There'll be some people who go out for a nice evening with friends, and there'll be some people who go out to kick off and to have trouble. And you know, it's just a sad reflection on society. You know, there's some awful people out there, but there are some wonderful people out there as well.
I think it's interesting what you say about a newer generation being worse than an older generation. I mean, I remember when the news started to filter through about Hillsborough, and I was at a game with the Hawthorns. But, you know, I remember thinking back to when we'd played Ipswich in the Cup semi-final in 78 and thinking, you know, that could have been us. And I think from an older generation, when something like that actually happened, and I think, you know, the Bradford fire was another thing, you thought, oh, that could have been us. Because nobody go with monkeys about us as supporters. They didn't care. We were in cages and we were in these stands that were falling down and they were overpopulated and there was, you know, all of that. And we, you know, apart from the fact that, I mean, I don't understand why anybody would ever sing about Hillsborough or Munich or any of those things. You know, people died. What the hell are you singing about? But people understood that could very easily, on another day.
A lot of people of that generation lived similar moments. You know, they'll have been in, you know, a lot of, you know, matchgoers, you know, that went on, and not just Leppins Lane, but, you know, so many other grounds that weren't fit for purpose and lived very similar experiences. So they could empathise, really, in a way that younger supporters can't, because they've never lived the terraces that were the Pens, you know, all of those dangers. You know, they've avoided, you know, which is great for them, but it's not great for the purposes of the, I don't know, the compassion towards something that happened, you know, before their time.
I think you're right. It seems to be very ingrained in the youth culture today. I've noticed a definite shift in the behaviour of supporters, of young people in general. I sound like an old git here, and I probably am sounding like an old git, but I think that there's a real relevance to the way people behave now, perhaps in the way they're consuming their time before matches, maybe with the freer use of drugs, alcohol as well, which has always been prevalent. But there is that side. You know, we saw it at the Euros final. We saw it in Paris in a different way. And I think you're right, Stephen. I think we can talk about it and we can moan about it, but I don't see how anything changes because I don't think there's an appetite for people to change.
No, some people just won't want to listen. They don't want to hear it. That's just, and it's not just, you know, Hillsborough and this particular topic, but you know, the many walks of life topics that are away from the football grounds. You know, there is a defined, you know, shut off that people don't want to know and don't want to hear. You know, but you know, there are happily a lot of very good people out there that continue to illuminate it, and you know, and not just Liverpool supporters. You know, David Conn is magnificent at putting it out there, and I think as well. I mean, there seems to be a growing culture of calling it out as well. I think, which is, you know, a pleasing aspect of this is that, you know, people who are being essentially, you know, if you're a bastard, you know, and you get called out for it, that bastard doesn't like being called out for being a bastard, you know, but they're going to have to get used to it because people will call you out, you know, and rightly so, I think. And that, I mean, that's, you know, for me, something to take into your day-to-day life in general. It doesn't have to be about football, you know.
Sorry, I've got to say, and on that note, what is very pleasing is to see that so many sports writers now, who were perhaps part of the problem in 1989 in terms of how they portrayed football fans, not just sports writers, but more so news writers, are now among the people putting these idiots right and putting them in their place. I think that the new generation of journalists who remember Hillsborough as children are now in a position where they are trying to educate people via social media, trying to put them right. And that is the pleasing aspect for me, as you say, Stephen, because it, all too often in those late 80s, when we had the circulation wars being waged between the tabloids, football fans weren't a consideration. They were somebody you slagged off on your front pages. They were somebody you hammered for being yobs, for being scum, for being drunk, for being this or that. Finally, we've got a generation of media who actually maybe are more considered, more educated, more erudite, and able to put the other people who are making these chants in their place.
Agreed. Well, moving on to something maybe a bit more upbeat. Dave, what have you brought us?
I'm not sure it's more upbeat. Rangers versus Aberdeen is the game on Saturday. And those two hate one another. So, I mean... that was something that was really, I think, came to fruition in the 80s. I mean, when Ferguson had got Aberdeen starting to win things, and I think the 82 Scottish Cup final was a case in point where Aberdeen absolutely pummeled Rangers in extra time. And but there was some through the 80s in particular, the kind of games where they didn't bother chucking the ball until, you know, about half an hour in, you know, when things had warmed up. But there was some horrific stuff back then. I mean, John McMaster from Aberdeen, he needed the kiss of life on the pitch after Willie Johnson stamped on him in 1918. Willie Johnson's excuse was that it was a mistaken identity. He thought he was stamping on Willie Miller. And then you've got the, I mean, if you like X-rated movies, you should go and find the Neil Simpson tackle on Ian Durant in, I think, 1998. Yes. And things have never really simmered down much since, but it's coming at an interesting time because obviously at Rangers, things are not going well. The way things are going in the Champions League, and Van Bronckhorst under huge pressure, and they lost, of course, 4-0 at Parkhead as well. So they're a team short on confidence, and I think it's a good time for Aberdeen to be going there, particularly because Rangers will be coming back from Napoli on Wednesday night, and the way things are going, you would fancy Napoli to get 5 or 6. I think Ibrox, like all the big stadiums, Ibrox can be a fantastic place. When you're winning and you're scoring goals and everything's going nicely. And when they've got a downer on the team, it's not such a great place to be playing, I think. And I think it's a point where Aberdeen have got to try and capitalise on that. I mean, I saw an article on the BBC earlier today about Aberdeen going to re-establish themselves as the third club in Scotland. which I think is a bit precipitant, because 2 weeks ago when they lost 4-0 at Tannadice, there was a crisis at Aberdeen. So, you know, I mean, that, but I think that says a lot about the Scottish League. You take the top two out, and it's really, you know, it's a cigarette paper between the other 10 a lot of the time. I think Aberdeen are going through an interesting time, though. I mean, they had that, it was about 7 years under Derek McInnes, where they were consistently the best of the rest, and they qualified for Europe every season. And they had and then that ran its course, going back to what we were saying about some of the other clubs. People got bored of the football. The fans started to turn on it. And they tried Stephen Glass last year and a more expansive football, and that lasted for about 6 months before he got the push. So, you know, you have to be careful what you wish for sometimes. But I think Aberdeen are starting to get it right again. Jim Goodwin's a good manager. I think he's, when he was at St Mirren, they were always a really well-organised team and knew what they were doing. And I think they've bought well. They sold well in the summer. They sold Calvin Ramsey to Liverpool for about £4 million, I think it was. Lewis Ferguson went to Italy for about another £3.5 million. And they've bought a couple of good forwards in Duke and Bojan Majovski. And they look a handful. So I think they've got, you know, promise for this season. The paradox is that Hearts were consistently the best last season. They were consistently the best, third best team in Scotland. And of course, they got what they wanted. They qualified for Europe. And they play in Europe all the way through till, well, ordinarily it would be Christmas now, it's the World Cup. Which of course has knackered Hearts for this season, because they play on a Thursday and a Sunday and they haven't got the squad for it. And now Hearts are struggling a bit this season. Aberdeen, of course, want to finish third next year, this season, go into Europe next year, and then they'll have to deal with it. So, I mean, I think in Scotland, as we said last week, the big issue is it's the distribution of money and the relative amounts of money that the clubs have got. You want to get into Europe, you get a bit more money for getting into Europe, but that's not enough money for you to boost your squad. And cope with the challenges of it. So, I mean, I think Aberdeen, it's a nice opportunity for them this year. I think the potential's there for them to go on and be the third club in Scotland. I mean, they're looking now at a new stadium, regeneration of the beach area in Aberdeen, which would, you know, improve the capacity and commercial opportunities and stuff. But your difficulty is, again, glass ceilings and all that stuff we were talking about earlier. You get to third place, that's kind of recipe for a disastrous year the following year, because you cannot keep going and playing all that football through till Christmas. So
it's that, you know, is it a curse, you know, to gain that European football? But, you know, as we spoke in the last episode when Paul brought us the Scottish Cup, you know, for an Aberdeen, you know, there has to be a degree of frustration for supporters that they see, you know, clubs that they must deem them to be lesser clubs that have walked away with, you know, domestic cups when they haven't, you know, and to have that, I don't know, that sense, there must be a sense of entitlement in a way that isn't being fulfilled for them. You know, I think you're right. I mean, that's going to be a fascinating game in so many ways, the historical context of it, but also the fact that Rangers are reaching a little bit of a critical point now. You know, I know one or two Rangers supporters myself, and you know, there's grumblings now. You know, these heavy beatings in the Champions League have been one thing, but to have a few adverse domestic results as well to go alongside it, and again, it's that hangover concept as well that we you know, suffered a bit at Anfield at the end of last season. It was the fact that, you know, the title slipped away from them to Celtic, and then they lost the Europa League final by penalties, which is always an awful way to lose out on something. And then they came back and won the Scottish Cup final. But some of the Rangers fans, I was intrigued to see how the Rangers fans that I knew would respond to that. And a lot of them were still disappointed with the lot, even, you know, despite winning that cup final at the end of last season. They were still licking the wounds over what they lost rather than celebrating what they gained. And there's a bit of that going into this season. And if that's an adverse result for them against Aberdeen, then it might start to get to the point where, I know, maybe a job will open up for Steven Gerrard all of a sudden.
I was just about to ask that, actually. What would be the chances of a Steven Gerrard return. I would probably think, would he be interested? I don't know.
I could imagine he'd be interested, but would he be welcome would be the question there. There was a lot of anger, I think, from certainly the Rangers fans I knew, that he walked away at a point in time when there was a lot to play for. I don't think they'd have blamed him had he gone at the end of the season, but there was a lot on the table at that point in time when he made that shift to Villa Park.
Mm. Of course, Sean Dyche hasn't yet picked up a club, has he? So, nope. You know, you could. I mean, I don't know whether Rangers would be what he wants, but, you know, while he's on the table, it's still a possibility. I mean, we talk about, Dave, you mentioned Aberdeen be Scotland's third club, but a win against Rangers in the next game, and all of a sudden that gap is down to 4 points, you know, and there's a whole psychological blow of that. I would suggest an Aberdeen win probably does finish him off, you'd have thought, Van Bronckhorst. But
I think for sure, yeah. I mean, I can't say we would survive, particularly if, you know, they do lose heavily against Napoli on Wednesday night. You know, you'd struggle to see how we would survive that. I mean, again, you go back to Alex Ferguson's time at Aberdeen, and I suppose it's an inspiration and a millstone around the neck for, you know, the current club. But he was always big about it. If you want to be taken seriously, you've got to go and win in Glasgow on a regular basis. And Aberdeen haven't done that for donkey's years. I mean, Derek McInnes' side won there occasionally, but they took quite a lot of beatings there as well and lost too easily there a lot of times. So for Jim Goodwin, I mean, he's an ambitious fella as well. And I think he'll be looking at next Saturday. Rangers coming from a European game, struggled against Livingston last Saturday. He'll be looking at them as a possible target. This will be a chance for them to have a signature result. And that would then really put a marker down for this season, going on and finishing third, I think.
Fantastic. Look forward to that one. Moving on to my topic, the Women's World Cup draw that was made during the week has kind of like got me looking forward to it in a way that I'm not looking forward to the men's version that's coming up in a few weeks' time. That doesn't actually feel like a World Cup. It might do by the time it kicks off, but, you know, it seems utterly, utterly bizarre to have a World Cup in November, December. To the point that because there's just so much football on the horizon and you're just looking at on a, I don't know, midweek to weekend basis. And the fact that the Men's World Cup won't have that 3 or 4 week separation from the end of the domestic season or two or three week. Separation. It's literally kind of going to be, you know, games finishing on November 13th, I think it is. And then 7 days later, there's a World Cup in Qatar. There's going to be no serious build-up to it. You know, that sense of anticipation is not going to be there. And I think the question marks and the, you know, everything that's been already be sounded about, you know, the rights and the wrongs of where this World Cup's going to be held, you know, has left a lot of people, I don't know, cold towards it, shall we say. But there's the Women's World Cup next summer, where we all feel a World Cup should be. And, you know, and it will also be, you know, a World Cup that has sprung up, I don't know, an interesting draw for England. I've felt that Serena Wiegmann has already come out very bullishly saying that she's confident that England will get through this group without too much of a problem. Yet, you know, it isn't a 24-team World Cup. This is a 32-team World Cup. You know, this is a tournament where only two teams will go through from each group. And, you know, that's a group that England will be sharing with, you know, a Denmark side that, you know, have a European Championship final in recent times to the name. They'll be in with China, who are, you know, 15th in the world and a nation that have reached a Women's World Cup final. And then still to be determined, but, you know, it could be Senegal or Haiti or Chile. And, you know, that looks, I don't know, an interesting kind of borderline group for England to navigate. You know, if they don't take it seriously enough, then they might come unstuck. I like the look of the USA, the group with Vietnam, the Netherlands, and what will either be Cameroon, Portugal or Thailand. You know, again, I don't think it's a particularly easy group. So for two of the nations that will have aspirations on winning it, you know, the clear favourites that should be the USA and England, who should be in a bullish frame of mind having won the European Championship. You know, I think they've got no easy ride into the knockout stages. Ireland, they're in with Australia, Nigeria and Canada. And I think what I'm looking forward to as well, I think Australia hosted the Women's World Cup. It's their chance to say, look, you know, we were denied the Men's World Cup and this is what we can do with a major tournament like this as well. And expanding the game in Australia as well, you know, which is, you know, the same can be said for Qatar, but, you know, expanding the game in a landmass that is, what, not much bigger than the West Midlands, shall we say?
More successful, probably.
a bit more spur cash hanging around, I'm sure. A little bit. But, the Women's World Cup, what are our thoughts on this, Chris?
I've just been looking at the groups, and it seems that group of Australia, the Republic of Ireland, Nigeria, Canada might well be England's opponents in the second round, if I'm looking at this correctly, which I think would be an interesting clash playing the hosts. I'm slightly a little bit concerned. I mean, there's always a after the Lord Mayor show in football. I find that very few countries have that ability to dominate from one tournament to another. You know, the men's Spanish team, I suppose, were one exception, and Germany had a knack of doing it. But it isn't easy, and with a few players retiring and England's women being a little bit older, maybe there's a mental hurdle about, we've already won this, we've already won a tournament, we've already been victors. Can we go on that next stage and presumably pit themselves against the USA as the team to beat? But it's going to be a tough ask. I mean, you would expect them to get through the group, but once you get into the knockouts, of course, you know, I mean, I don't know, looking at the flow in front of me, where they would stand to meet the USA potentially, but have they been split? Have they?
They're in the opposite half.
So we're thinking there might be a USA England final, perhaps if the script remains on piste. But you know, who knows? I think it could be very interesting, and presumably we're going to be watching these games in the middle of the night as well. Is that right? New Zealand
I think so. Yeah, I think we're looking at some very early get-ups to watch some of these games. It's certainly kind of like early morning. Kind of like 4-ish, 5-ish and so on. Maybe as late as kind of like mid-morning our time.
Hopefully spared any breakfast with John Motson jokes as we were during the World Cup of 2002. But no, I think England, if they can overcome the retirement of the players who have called it a day, and if they can get that mental block of having already won, and the real strength of a winning team is to actually defend, I know they wouldn't be defending the Euros at the World Cup, but to then go on and win another trophy in quick succession. I think that would be a real marker of the progress that this team have made.
Of course, this will be a Winter World Cup as well, Dave. You know, yeah. What difference are we expecting there? I mean, it could be weather that suits an English national side.
I think it'd certainly be better than trying to play in the middle of their summer. I mean, I think England have got every reason to be bullish about it, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I take Chris's point about how difficult it is to win back-to-back tournaments. I think it's eased a little bit because it's only a year on rather than 2 years on. So it's that much closer. I think what was impressive was the way that they beat USA at Wembley a couple of weeks ago. I mean, that would have been an easy one to, you know, be a bit overexcited by the whole occasion and what they'd achieved and all of that. But to actually come through and win that game, I think that was a bit of a statement. You're right. I mean, again, Ellen White and Jill Scott retiring, for instance, it seems a big thing. But I mean, you know, you go back 2 years and you could never have imagined an England side without Steph Orton. Mm. And they just won the Euros, like it didn't matter. You know, so I think there's a greater depth than there's been at all. I think the big thing, looking at the way that the groups work, if they do win the group and come through the second round, the quarterfinal, semi-final and final are all in Sydney. And that, yeah. that will be a big help. Because there'll be some, you know, some countries will be able to do big distances across Australia to play in the, in the various games through there. So, I mean, I think if they could win the group, then they've got a reasonable path at that. So, potential quarterfinal with Germany, notwithstanding. But,
of course. Wouldn't have it any other way.
Absolutely. but, you know, I think Serena Wiegmann is quite right to be positive about it, confident about it. I wouldn't have thought there was any team in world football at the minute that would fancy playing England, particularly after that, that win over the USA.
And of course, there'll be a big expat support about there. You know, you mentioned Sydney. That'll be massive. That'll be huge, you know, having a contingent of supporters out there to roar them on, I think will be a massive boost for them in that respect.
I think they've got a you know, reasonable chance of doing that. You know, it's a year away. Who gets injured? Who appears? Who, you know, what are the countries? Some star appears from nowhere and that kind of thing, which always happens at World Cups. But as we stand at this minute, you know, I think they've got every reason to be optimistic about it.
Oh, fantastic! I am. I think after this little chat, I'm looking forward to it all the more. I could easily bypass Qatar and let's just go for Australia. Might even get the sticker book
as well. Stephen, I just hope there's a team with a kit as good as the one that you're currently wearing, which for people Denmark 1986 shirt, one of the best, one of the classics out there.
Oh, God bless Hummel for doing the reprint of this one. I'm looking desperate for them to do an 84 one as well, which is kind of like a reversible Arsenal shirt almost. I'm absolutely looking forward to it hugely. Thanks, Chris, for a wonderful hour and 20 odd minutes. This has run out to be.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Excellent. And thanks, Dave, so much. And Dave will be doing the editing of this as well. Another double shift for Dave.
What better way to spend a Sunday evening?
Well, that's it. Everyone else has been on Strictly Come Dancing. You know, I'm sure we've all got it set to record instead. But yes, this has been a brilliant podcast again. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Lob from These Football Times, and we'll see you next time.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.